Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to 286th episode of Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 285 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com, and look under the radio show tab for the previous links. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and in the world. Try it and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. We have some great guests still on the queue beginning tonight. I hope you'll join us also next week at this same time for my interview with writer, poet, and memorist Alinda with a Y Coop. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 22nd year, at 6:30 p.m. at the Mahopac Library on 6th in Mahopac. More than 150 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So August meeting will be on Wednesday, August 21st at 10 a.m. This month, we will meet in the Hill Boulevard Diner at 3665 Hill Boulevard, just west of Route 6 in Jefferson Valley, just across Route 6 from the Jefferson Valley Mall. Our normal meeting place, Coffee Time, on 6th End in the Red Mills Shopping Center, will be on vacation this month, so we'll be at a new place for August. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30, and the Yorktown one is on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hutt Library in Sherbrooke, New York at 6 p.m. In August, the Mahopac workshop will meet on August 14th, while the Yorktown one will next meet on Wednesday, August 28th. And finally, the next open mic at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center in the Philipsing Manor train station in Sleepy Hollow will be on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, the 286 in the series. Tonight, I'm joined by Coco Cream McMullins, ophthalmologist, doctor of veterinarian medicine, Kyle Toffelmeyer. I first met Kyle from my normal veterinarian's office, recommended that I take my recently acquired rescue kitten to the pet ophthalmologist due to her swollen and red eyes, and suggested Kyle's group. At that time, I didn't even know what the pet ophthalmologist was, but now I do, and you, the audience, will know soon. The listeners wishing to join Kyle and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally have caller participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, Kyle, and welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Where'd you grow up then go to early school?
I grew up in Windsor, Ontario, which is across the Canadian border from Detroit. I'm Canadian. I went to school in that town, Hugh Beaton Bulldogs was my grade school. It was a good little grade school. In fact, I was back there about a year ago and actually just discovered that they closed permanently after June of 2018, which is kind of sad. It's kind of changing times, I guess. I think they're consolidating to much, much larger grade schools in the area at this point, which is probably economically logical. But unfortunately, for people like me who have good memories of the area, we have to live with it. I went to high school in the same area. Kenny Clippers was my high school, and I was back there at the same time. And, it's interesting because my physics teacher, who's a great guy, who taught me grade 9, I believe, is now the principal there. And my chemistry teacher is now the vice principal. And so these guys have moved up, and they're both fantastic. Actually, I didn't recognize any of the other teachers there, but that one's still open and doing well, it appears.
It might have been sadder if your grammar school had changed the year after you graduated, then you might have thought that you caused it or something.
Yes, that's true.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
My earliest aspirations, I wanted to do two things. I wanted to be a veterinarian, which is kind of what I'm doing with a spin, and I wanted to be a competitive swimmer. And I achieved one of those goals. I was a competitive swimmer when I was younger, and if you Google my name, that's one of the things you can kind of find amongst some of my veterinary web searches, I guess. It's kind of an odd thing to do as a kid, though. It's a very asocial sport, and as a 10, 15-year-old kid, it's a kind of a challenging thing to do. You spend, 2 hours in the morning swimming, 2 hours in the evening swimming, and you're basically face first in the water. You're not really communicating with anybody. There's coaches and other swimmers around. But it's very, very isolated, so to speak. I always remember, kind of daydreaming during my swimming practice and less so during events. One of the things that stood out to me is I remember watching or seeing a Michael Phelps interview probably 3-5 years ago, whenever the most recent Olympics was, where he won all those medals and broke those records. I remember seeing him talk, and he said he would go to bed every night and he could visualize every single stroke he would take in every single event. He could dive into the water and know exactly how many strokes it took to get to the other side You could push off the other side and know exactly how many strokes it took to get back. And as he got further and further into the event, he would fatigue. And so his stroke numbers changed. And he still knew exactly how many it took at any given step. And, you know, that's an amazing amount of discipline that, you know, I'm not sure if many kids have. And that's probably why he's the guy he is. But it's funny when you look at it with that perspective. It's really kind of bordering obsessive. And, you know, considering he was an Olympian when he was 16, you know, I wasn't even in the same league as someone as amazing as that. But it was an aspiration for a relatively naive kid.
It's something, though, that you do get. I remember when I was actually doing computer programming, I would wake up in the middle of the night and I could almost see a logic diagram on the ceiling. And that went away over the years. But if you're really into something before you go to sleep, maybe it stays with you. Were you an early reader?
I wasn't an early reader. You know, it took me years and years and years to kind of get into books. In fact, you know, I mean, I was actually slow to pick up reading to begin with. I remember being fifth, sixth grade and really struggling with reading. And, you know, it wasn't until I was probably about 20 where I really started picking up reading. And, you know, I went through the typical young adult fiction stuff, a few, you know, historic literature and that kind of thing. But more recently, I'm a self-help reader. I read a lot of self-help books. I don't read as much as I probably should, but I get through probably one every 4 to 6 weeks, which is pretty good, I think. The most recent one I read, or I guess the most recent one that I read that's particularly memorable, was probably 4 or 6 months ago, called Essentialism. Have you read this?
No, I haven't. Tell me about it.
Yeah. So this is an interesting one. The thesis of the book, and you're really the take-home point is, you know, there's all kinds of noise that we deal with every day. There's all kinds of distractions and opportunities that arise that really just suck our time. And the thesis of the book is if the answer to an opportunity isn't hell yeah, the answer is no. And I thought that this was really kind of an interesting thing because, you know, doing what I do for a living, it becomes a very consuming life or consuming part of your life. And, you know, so I really tried to take this to heart a little bit and turn down all the, you know, less appealing opportunities in favor of selecting really, really the only exceptional ones. And, you know, I think so far so good, but I got to practice it a little bit more since it has been a relatively brief period of time. But it's a very interesting book, particularly if you feel yourself kind of getting bogged down in the less important parts of your life. And this applies to, you know, family and professional life and so on. And you know, for me, I've applied to my professional life more than anything because I keep everything else pretty simple. But, you know, I do recommend it fairly highly if you are a busy person who feels overwhelmed sometimes.
There's so many books now that are out in this area. There are many saying that you have to increase your concentration in what you do. And there are others that say, no, you got to be a generalist. You have to enjoy your life. You have to have a balance. And most of us, when we're doing something that we like, whether it's as a veterinarian or as a computer programmer or something else, that becomes our recreation also. And in the end, you wind up saying, was that a good idea 20 years ago? You know, but it's, of course it is then when we're doing it because we feel not only are we successful at what we do, but we're making a contribution to something or other. You know, so
yeah, it's absolutely agree.
What happened after high school? Did you continue down the path of science, and where'd you go to college?
Yeah, so I, in high school, you know, I guess I didn't touch on this, but in high school, you know, I was a pretty average student in pretty well every way. You know, I didn't really do anything particularly exceptional. I got, you know, high B's, low A's, that type of thing. So I was, you know, a pretty average student. And, you know, I moved to Texas from Ontario right after high school, you know, my family, my immediate family, you know, just kind of picked up and left. My mom remarried and that kind of thing. So we ended up just picking up shop and moving down here. It's literally like June 21st, which was maybe the day after I took my final exam in high school. And we moved on down to Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, which, you know, was an interesting change. You know, they say everything's bigger in Texas, and when you come from Canada, I think that's true. You know, lots of highways, very commercial, big. You know, for what it's worth, I do think the Texans do practice sales and hospitality. I think, you know, even compared to Canadians, at least where I was from, Texans were generally pretty friendly. And there's also a fair amount of road rage, which maybe offsets that a little bit. But you know, ultimately, I went to Texas, University of North Texas, which is in Denton, just a little bit north of Dallas-Fort Worth. So I lived at home for a year or two during my undergrad there. And, you know, what's interesting is I met with a counselor. She was a PhD counselor of some kind. I don't even remember really her name. You know, prior to even beginning my first semester there, and I said, hey, you know, I want to be a veterinarian. What do I have to do? And she said, well, here's some guidelines I usually suggest. And she, I think there was even something printed off. And she had said, you know, I had a few people apply to vet school in the recent past. Nobody's been lucky enough to get in. And if you need to get in, if you want to get in, here's all the things you need to do. And one of the requirements, probably the biggest requirement that I saw on the paper that I remember was you need to have a Bachelor of Science in something to apply to Texas A&M, specifically College of Veterinary Medicine. And I remember looking at that and thinking, you know, there's a lot of fluff that goes into these undergraduate degrees. And don't get me wrong, I think there's definitely value in being educated diversely like that. But I remember thinking, you know, I'm 20, I'm getting, or 19, or 18, or however old I was at the time, thinking, you know, I don't want to spend my life in school. And so then I looked into that a little bit further, and it turns out Texas A&M didn't require a bachelor's degree to get in. They had a list, a fairly extensive list of prerequisite classes. And so I thought, well, I'm going to knock out those prerequisite classes and then apply to Texas A&M and see if I get in. And so the next, I think I took 24 months. I think it was from that point to 24 months later, I got all those prereqs done. And I applied to Texas A&M on a whim, thinking it's only going to cost me a few $100. And if I don't get in, you know, I'll get my bachelor's and try again. Well, fortunate in that I got in, and you know, it helps that I, you know, had a fair amount of work experience with veterinarians along the way. I had pretty good references. I did very, very well in college. You know, it was one of these things where even though I was an average high school student, I looked at what I needed to do and said, you know, this should not be that hard. And so I just put my nose down and got all the work done, and you know, ended up doing very, very well academically. And in combination with the experience that I got with veterinarians and the references, they let me in. And you know, so I was 20 years old getting into veterinary school, and you know, spent 4 years at Texas A&M, finished with a doctorate, you know, when I was 24. So did pretty good in vet school. You know, I graduated with honors and, you know, got, again, decent references. I should have been more gregarious in retrospect. But, you know, I think I got the job done and subsequently moved on from there. So that was really my university college experience.
I'm told that it's supposed to be harder to get into veterinary school, the medical school, at least in the Northeast. And the daughter of a friend of ours had applied to Cornell and to Tufts. And she was on the waiting list, and she wound up going to down in the Caribbean to
yep.
a school in St. Kitts. And
mm-hmm.
after 2 years there, Tufts would take her if she did well. And in her last semester, early in the semester, and she was doing very well, the United States arrested some criminal from St. Kitts who was called the Big Rat, and. He put out the vendetta on all the Americans on the island. He wanted them all killed. And,
wow.
Of course, everyone panicked. And the school started sending them home. And Tufts agreed to take her without her finishing the courses there. And then she wound up going to Tufts, and she became a vet. But I thought that was a pretty scary situation.
Yeah, that's actually kind of interesting because I have, you know, I texted him. We had similar, you know, Ross, which is the vet school in St. Kitts. We had Ross students come hang out with us for the last year of the training, and during my internships and residencies, it was similar. I did those at academic institutions, and I remember talking to one student who was just, you know, finishing her clinical year with us at Iowa State, and she told me a story where she would go running on the island, and she always ran with a little knife just to be on the safe side. And one time she was running, and somebody grabbed her, and she swung backwards and got out of dodge. And, you know, she said, you know, she saw her life flash before her eyes and all that. So, you know, I don't know what it is, but it probably wasn't particularly safe. It sounds like it was probably safe on the campus and in the immediate area. But I think if you venture out too far, maybe you did encounter some problems like that.
Wow. Does one specialize well in vet school, or does that come later?
That comes later. That's a process. It's the same process as physicians, really, where, you know, you kind of go through medical school, then you do an internship, and then you do a residency, and then you're a specialist, and then if you choose, you can subspecialize at least to some really limited degree in veterinary medicine. The physicians tend to subspecialize much, much more commonly. So, you know, essentially, I finished at Texas A&M. I went to Arizona, where I did an internship, which was, you know, kind of a nice place to live. I was in Tucson. You know, because, you know, medicine, as you alluded to, is a challenging thing to do and has a steep learning curve. And, you know, I think a lot of people use internships to soften the learning curve. And even though, you know, it's fairly intense and frustrating and emotional at times, it probably is key for a lot of people to figure out where they're going with a career and what their professional goals really are. And so during that time, I worked with a number of very good doctors and subsequently applied for a residency to any number of institutions. There's only about 8 or 10 ophthalmology specialties in veterinary medicine every year, so it's very competitive to get in, and I ended up getting one at Iowa State University, which, you know, sounds like an odd place, but it's in Ames, Iowa, next, you know, very close to Des Moines. Nice little college town, very, very safe. It's the first vet school in the country, as I recall. You know, I don't remember the date it was founded, but it was, you know, the first and the oldest at this point. I worked under four ophthalmologists, you know, maybe five if you count one that was in and out. You know, I received some awards as resident of the year 1 year, and received some award for a pathophysiology seminar on glaucoma surgery. Glaucoma is one of these very challenging diseases that we deal with fairly commonly. I was taught a lot of good things. You know, I worked under a lot of good people, so I learned a lot of good things, you know, professional things, medical things, surgical things, social things, probably to some degree. You know, what I do is challenging. It's maybe not as challenging as some of the more social or emotional jobs in veterinary medicine, but it is challenging in the technical sense. You know, and I always think about this. It's one of the main things I remember from my training at Iowa State is, you know, if you control your breathing, you can control your hands. And, you know, that sounds kind of funny because it's just a way of saying, you know, it's a glorified way of saying just take a deep breath if you're stressed out. But I think that this is absolutely 100% true because, you know, again, doing what I do is very technically challenging. You know, to give you an idea, you know, I do surgery under a microscope. Yeah, I mean, I help patients like Coco, but really, you know, my bread and butter is doing surgery under a microscope. I do microsurgery. And to do this, you know, if you have even a small shake of your hand, a small tremor of your hands, you know, your job is much, much, much harder. And it's amazing the number of things that can negatively affect how stable your hands are. You know, lack of sleep, if you work out in the mornings, you're drinking coffee or not drinking coffee, you know, sugars, stress, you know, if you have personal stressors in your life and you're not entirely focused on what you should be doing. And, you know, probably the most common one that I personally encounter is and, you know, probably, you know, most surgeons probably experience this is, you know, when you start dealing with a complication, something starts going wrong during the procedure. What happens? You get nervous and you start anticipating things. And when you start getting nervous, your hands shake. And it's amazing how much your hands can shake. And so when you control your breathing, you can control your hands. And sometimes, you know, if I'm having a bad day, sometimes I think about my breathing more than I think about the surgery because, you know, surgery, although it's technically challenging, much like most technical jobs, once you do it 1,000, 10,000 times, you know, it's muscle memory for the most part. And so sometimes if I just need steady hands, I can control my breathing and put everything on else on autopilot and through things without any problem. And so I always remember that kind of lesson that one of my mentors taught me, control your breathing, control your hands.
It's interesting because my late first cousin was a doctor in World War II, and a few years after the war, he became an ophthalmologist after post-work to the GI Bill. And he was, and I run into people coincidentally who knew him in the Washington area, and they said he had the best reputation in the area, and he was known for all this. And all of a sudden, he got Meniere's disease, which caused some problem with his balance with the ears, and he had to give up surgery for over 3 years until they're able to deal with it. So I can understand just what you're saying.
Yeah, I believe that. I had, I was going to say, one of my mentors, who's Dan Betts, he's an ophthalmologist, spent his career at Iowa State. He was 76 when I met him. And much like most people that do what I do, you know, we have a very finite, you know, a physical ability to do our jobs. You know, your hands start shaking, you're out of the game. And it's amazing he lasted as long as he did, but you know, I think most people in my field, you know, probably only last until their mid-60s, you know, maybe even late 50s in some cases, because, you know, you just can't maintain that stability of your hands. And then you have the added issue of, you know, we're very dependent on our eyesight too. And so if we can't see exactly what we're doing at any given time, you know, we need to start phasing ourselves out. So it is a very physically, in an untraditional way, a very physically demanding job.
It's interesting. I also have the dog and to all the cats, and I had to give up the dog when I was 5 and a half because I'm very allergic to dogs, and I didn't realize until about 10 years ago that I could have the dogs that don't shed, the ones you have to spend megabucks to take them to the groomer. So I have this silky terrier, and we found a place where we go on vacation down in the Wild, New Jersey, that takes dogs. And in talking to the people, it turned out that they were during the winter they were at home in the Maryland area, and that their ophthalmologist was my cousin. That's one of these small world things, you know. So, what made you choose ophthalmology to begin with, do you remember?
Yeah, I mean that's a tough question to answer. I get that question posed a lot by clients that come in to see me saying exactly what you said. You know, we didn't even know this was a thing. What made you do it? You know, here's the thing. When I moved to Texas, you know, I was looking to gain, you know, some experience in the veterinary field. And part of what we did back then, before, you know, online resumes and all this stuff were that big, you know, I opened the phone book and I went down the list of veterinary clinics within a reasonable driving distance. And on, you know, in that phone book was an animal eye clinic is what it was called. And Mike Carlson was a veterinary ophthalmologist there. He became a veterinary ophthalmologist. I think he said he had been doing it for about 15 years before I met him. So I guess that puts them in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s type of time frame. And he, on a whim, you know, asked me to come do an interview. So I just met with him and told him I was a kid, didn't really know much, but, you know, I can work hard. I can work for, you know, more or less minimum wage. And so he ended up hiring me. And I thought the same thing most people think, what the heck? What am I doing with a veterinary eye doctor? And so I ended up working with him for, you know, 2 years while I was doing my undergraduate stuff. Then I went to vet school, so I couldn't continue working there because of the distance. And you know, during that time frame, you know, I saw the cool things he does. And you know, you were privy to seeing, you know, the examination. You know, we have some specialized equipment to do the exams. But really, you know, the special equipment comes with some of the surgeries that we do. You know, I alluded to an operating microscope before. You know, we do cataract extractions, which require some very specialized units. You know, we do various types of laser procedures and so on and so on. And so, you know, it's really kind of an interesting field in that we have a lot of unique abilities that other specialists even don't have. You know, people always think that, you know, surgeons are kind of the glorified or the glory takers in medicine. And that's true to some extent. But, you know, when you really break it down, they're not really doing anything that's too exciting. You know, they're removing some big organs or they're, you know, putting some bones back together. But, you know, I always thought ophthalmologists kind of had a unique way to do things and a very unique skill set. And, you know, don't get me wrong, you know, it's a skill set that, you know, outside of first world country might not be that valuable. You know, I always think of some of these disaster movies, you know, where the comet's rushing toward Earth. And, you know, the scientists are all funneling people into the life-sustaining biodomes, you know. And I don't kid myself. I probably wouldn't make that list of people allowed into the biodome. You know, my skill set is not the one that people need to survive. But it is a very interesting, very challenging position to have. And so, you know, when I was in vet school, I was trying to determine what I'd like to do. And, you know, I entertained some ideas similar to what a lot of people entertain, you know, internal medicine and surgery. And particularly I always kind of liked oncology because it was, a fairly noble thing to be doing. But ultimately, you know, what it came down to is, you know, I liked ophthalmology. It was a nice hybrid of medical stuff and surgical things that would let me have a fairly balanced professional life. And, you know, that's basically why I ended up doing what I'm doing. And certainly there's probably some comfort in having a background, a strong background in ophthalmology. It always came very easy to me because I had a little bit of a head start compared to a lot of people. And, you know, I guess the rest is history.
There are obvious differences between working with humans and animals. You can't ask a dog or a cat or a horse to read an eye chart, for instance. What are the less mm-hmm. obvious differences?
Yeah, so, you know, and, you know, I just feel the need to you know, correct maybe the misconception that some people might be hearing is, you know, I want to be clear that, you know, an optometrist is the one that kind of suits glasses and you know, make sure you're refractive. And I know you know that, but I just felt the need to relay that. An ophthalmologist, conversely, you know, diagnoses and treats diseases. And, you know, the most challenging part of my job is always quantifying how much animals can see. You know, that's a common question I get is, how much can my pet see? And, you know, and you may very well be posing that question to me regarding Coco at some point. And the bottom line is, it's the best guess, you know, because you're absolutely right. We cannot make them read an eye chart. We don't have visual acuity testing, at least not to any practical degree. And so, you know, I think that that's a big difference. But you're right, you know, that maybe is an obvious one. The other obvious one is, I don't want at the fear of getting into the list of my pet peeves. you know, I really dislike the presumption that some diseases in animals develop naturally and or are expected to occur. And what I mean by that is I hate when people come in to see me, and I hate is maybe a strong word, but I dislike when people come in to see me and say, oh, well, you know, I had some dog years ago and it went blind because, you know, dogs go blind when they get older. You know, that's not okay. That's not what's supposed to happen. You know, it's a disease that's causing these animals to have these symptoms. And I always try to tell people, you know, if this were a person, you know, what would you
right.
think? You know what I mean? Because, you know, there can be some substantial oversights just because we dismiss some problems because they are animals. And the unfortunate thing is, much like most of veterinary medicine, by the time, you know, some of these patients make it to a veterinarian or someone qualified to help, oftentimes it's pretty late in the disease process. And so early recognition is very, very important for almost everything we do. And when I say early recognition, that's still not even close to as early as when you recognize problems in people. And so the physicians really have, you know, an enormous advantage when it comes to truly diagnosing early diseases and managing early diseases. And I often tell people that's perhaps why we're often not as successful with certain diseases as they are in people, because we're diagnosing them much later, and there's been time for new problems or consequent problems to develop.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I was very happy that my vets sent me off to you, even though I had no experience with that. It was that they realized this was not something that they saw all the time and were comfortable diagnosing or working with it. On my own internal medicine doc, he's like that. He'll send me all over the places to various places.
Yeah.
My ophthalmologist, who's performed my cataract, is I have tremendous confidence in him, and it's very important to have confidence in your doctor. What about the types of animals? Are there also differences there between dogs and cats and bigger animals?
Yeah, there are enormous differences in types of animals. You know, differences in how they see, what they see. Birds see UV light. Can you imagine seeing a whole nother end of the color spectrum? I mean, you know, it's an enormous amount of difference. You know, some deer see UV light too, which is kind of interesting, because presumably the idea is they can kind of see through some of the surface layers of snow and find food underneath, which I always thought was kind of an interesting tidbit. You know, some of the sea life is very interesting too. I don't remember some of the details about sea life. You should have told me you'd ask that question, because I could have prompted my memory. It's been a long time since I thought about that. But you know, they have different types of photoreceptors or refractive indexes. They bend light differently in their eyes that allows them to see very differently. For instance, you know, if you or I go underwater, everything's blurry, right? But some of most of the sea life, and some of the pinnipeds, seals, otters, those types of animals, you know, they may be, you know, in focus underwater, but then they come into, you know, outside of water and air. Now they're defocused, just like we are in water, and so, you know, their eyes are really built very differently. And you know, some animals that are really lucky, they can adapt their eyes based on where they are. You know, they go underwater, they see perfectly. They go out of water, their eyes adjust, and now they can see perfectly outside of water too. And so it's really interesting, some of these adaptive mechanisms. I believe there's a book, a fairly exhaustive book, on the evolution of the eye. That may be the title of the book, that talks about all these differences and how, you know, they all developed you know, from each other. And, you know, there's this idea that even some eyes develop independently of another. You know, like we develop multiple ways as, you know, as life on Earth to see light rays differently from the very beginning. And so I always thought that was kind of interesting. And I'm kind of getting sidetracked. I don't even remember what your question was.
That's the different animals. So I'm amazed. I feed not only my own animals, and we've got two turtles and the three cats now and the dog, but also birds and squirrels and groundhogs, and there's a raccoon, and there's deer around here. But I can walk by a glass door, and just the change in the light that I make will cause the groundhog, that's the most skittish people, to take off. And I know that I haven't done anything, that I haven't gone near the door. It's just I'm changing what's coming from one window through the door, and they're gone. It doesn't bother the squirrels at all, or the raccoon, or any of that. You know, there's some difference that they sense anyhow through changes.
Yeah. And And you know, some of that may be, you know, more of the predator-prey psychology that play, you know. And one of the things I used to teach students is, you know, if you try to, you know, if you look at my finger and I, you know, move my finger, you can stare at my finger and track it perfectly smoothly, right? And that's because, you know, you and I and most species, for that matter, were designed to track moving objects, right? And that's why, you know, you can see, you know, you can see a rabbit running across, you know, a field pretty easily. But conversely, we're not really trained or designed to see stationary objects that well. You know, like if you were to look at the corner of the room, I'm doing it right now, and you were to try to track your eyes very smoothly across from where the wall hits the ceiling, you don't. You cannot track your eyes will not track very smoothly as if you're looking at my finger. Your eyes will kind of flicker. You'll look at one spot, then you'll look at the next spot, then you'll look at the next one. It won't be smooth movement because you're not designed to look at stationary things. You're designed to look at movement. And so I always think that that's kind of interesting, and that's the same reason why, you know, if a rabbit, that's exactly why, like, a rabbit or, you know, will pause, you know, if they see you or a potential predator approaching. It's because they know if they bolt, they're very easily tracked, but if they hold still, they sometimes blend in and they can kind of slip by the radar. And so I always thought that that was kind of an interesting, you know, again, evolutionary development for different species. And, you know, I guess the other thing to consider is, you know, your groundhog thing is, you know, we're definitely built differently. You know, the rods and cones, you know, rods are very important for like dim light function, and cones are very important for color and bright light. And so you and I, we're designed to see color and bright light. But some of these rodents, and even to a lesser extent, dogs and cats, they're designed to see in the dark, right? And so, you know, these changes in light, you know, can have enormous influence on things that you or I might dismiss.
It's also very interesting, and this is a bit out of your field, but we've been where we are for 40 years. And approximately 20 years ago, the bats who used to be up in the trees disappeared. I've noticed in the last 3 or 4 years, the rabbits who used to be all over, they're gone, and there's very few skunks around. And but there are the raccoons and the squirrels and those other animals. I'm just wondering to what's going on, to whether it's I still have deer on my property, so it's not the people they're building around and they're taking the area for these, or I assume the deer would be gone. But I'm just wondering what the changes are.
I guess I wouldn't even know where to start. I don't know.
Yeah, I believe that you began your own practice in Seattle, and I think that you told me that you're also in Oklahoma for a few years. What were those years like?
Yeah, I actually, you know, I'm not the Oklahoma thing. I think you might be misremembering, but I was in Seattle. I spent, you know, I finished my residency, you know, from Iowa State, and I took a job in Seattle. I didn't start my own practice, but I took a job in Seattle. It was a big ophthalmology clinic. It was, you know, four of us, you know, four ophthalmologists at a practice there, and so it was a big group of people. And it was really, you know, the biggest clinic by a substantial margin in Seattle. And, you know, it's a great part of the country. It's a beautiful place to live. You know, the community is, you know, generally pretty good. You know, the Seattle freeze is one of the things people talk about when you move there. And, you know, some of the people that aren't directly known to the community are kind of shut down. And, you know, people don't really say hi on the streets and that type of thing. But, you know, you kind of get over that. And, you know, the people are the same just about anywhere else. And, you know, it was a good experience. You know, I'm not sure I have anything profound to say about this, you know, except that, you know, it may be the most scenic part of the country out there. The weather, if you can deal with, you know, more than a few months of clouds a year, is just about perfect for someone like me. It stays between like maybe 45, 50 degrees and, you know, about 80 or 85 all year round, which to me is great. You know, I hate being cold. I hate being too hot. And so it's a nice ambient temperature generally, if you don't mind the dampness. You know, my job out there was very similar to what it is here. You know, I'm currently you know, I won't get into it quite yet, but you know, I did basically the same thing out there as I currently do.
Yeah, I could handle spring and fall all year round. We were out in Seattle. It must have been 20 years ago on business, and I loved that ferry going out to whatever the island is. And
maybe Vashon Island. I wonder.
Yeah, I rode back and forth just to be on it. And my son, we found a place down near the waterfront where they had movie scripts. And my son's a screenwriter now, so he loved the area. So you're out there about 2 weeks.
I mean, it really is a great part of the country, you know. And, you know, I'm sure it's changed in the last 20 years with the exploding population and whatnot. But, you know, even the downtown still isn't particularly overwhelming. It still, you know, has the kind of quaint environment that I think a lot of the Seattleites like to boast about. You know, there's still these amazing little pockets of very much like New York City, of like only locally known gems. And so, yeah, I mean,
there are two things that amazed me. Was number one, the free bus service within the city limits, and two, that Mount Rainier looked like it was about 10 blocks away when it was really 90 miles, whatever it is. You know, it's just so big. You know, I thought that was very interesting.
Yep, and they say it's supposed to explode in the next 70 years or something, so it's a little scary, but yeah, you know, I agree. You know, I remember sitting on the, you know, in a plane, you know, seeing, you know, on the landing strip and thinking, holy cow, that thing's closed. But you're right, it if you want to drive there, it takes a while.
Yeah, we flew over what's the, where I went off, the, coming up from San Francisco, over the place that had the explosions, I guess years ago, and you could still see the hot lava down in it.
Wow,
that was scary. Now, there was the mix of animals that you've treated in there different than in Iowa or in Texas or in with the different animals?
So to give you kind of a feel of things, you know, in veterinary school when I was in Texas, you're basically required as veterinarians to be well versed in everything. You have to do dogs and cats, you have to do horses, you have to do cattle, you have to do pigs and goats and lamb. So you really have to be, you know, we did some ostriches and, you know, some, you know, to a lesser extent birds. But, you know, you really do a fairly diverse group of species, which, I mean, is very appropriate by nature. Right now in the veterinary community, there's this big argument going on about whether or not it's appropriate for a vet student to come out of school and only have ever worked on dogs and cats, you know, because that's where, you know, most of the industry is. But there's still an enormous need for veterinarians well-versed in cattle and horses and you know, some of these other animals. And so, you know, there's a debate about, you know, whether or not, you know, some of these people should have limited licenses, meaning I can only work on these animals. If someone brings in some other species, they have to turn them away, which a lot of them are opting to do anyways, but, you know, now to be legally required, you know, and I don't want to mislead you and tell you that that's what's happening, because it's not, but that's one of the debates or discussions that are being had. You know, when I was in Arizona, you know, I primarily did dogs and cats because I was an intern. I was mostly doing emergency duties and working among a few other specialists. In Iowa, I did primarily dogs and cats and horses. I did a lot of horses in Iowa, which was great because, you know, equine ophthalmology is a big, big deal. You know, horses have these really, really fragile eyes. They get very unique diseases and they need very unique treatment strategies. You know, I mean, try putting an eye drop in a horse, right? You know, they really need some creative management. And so I always thought that was a really, really nice challenge. We also did a fair number of exotics. You know, we did some birds, which for the most part are like the birds that are hit by cars or fly into windows and they have these traumatic eye injuries that need to be dealt with. A few lizards, not snakes, those types of things. Nothing too prominent though. In Seattle,
the anesthesia that's required for between a horse and a small cat or a bird.
Yeah, there's definitely special facilities. You know, in horses, we did tend to do a lot of things under what we call standing sedation, meaning we really knock them out heavily. And horses have this kind of locking mechanism in their pelvic limbs, where they can kind of lock their knees and hips into place and still stand up and basically be asleep.
Oh wow!
And you know, so some of them can actually sleep. So most of them actually sleep with their eyes open, or with their you know, their legs locked like that standing. But it is a little dangerous because, you know, you give them a whiff too much and they can collapse on you, and now you got a whole new problem to deal with. You know, so certainly, you know, knocking them down completely is generally a little bit safer, but, you know, the infrastructure that's needed, and, you know, I wish I could kind of show some people, you know, that aren't familiar with it, what it's actually like, because, you know, you knock them down in this padded cell, basically. It looks like a cell from an insane asylum. So that when they fall down, they don't hurt themselves. And we do it in a kind of a controlled fashion by, like, squeezing them between a door-like mechanism so they don't completely just flop on the ground. And then we hook their legs up to some chains, and we use some automated lifting mechanism to lift them up and hoist them onto a table, which we then roll into a sterile OR, or operating room. And then, you know, we position them under an operating microscope if they do what I do, or, you know, some of the colic surgeons would, you know, need them positioned on their back so they can get into the abdomen and so on. And so it's really a process to do this type of stuff. And, you know, to keep them under for any length of time is really dangerous. They tend to get you know, like muscle necrosis or nerve injuries just by their sheer weight of being put on in kind of an abnormal position on the table. And so, you know, to me, I always look at this situation like, holy cow, you do all this for $1,500? You know, it's really amazing what some of these people do. And, you know, I'd like to say that I did a lot of it too, but in reality, you know, I didn't. You know, I was a surgeon. I came in, I did surgery, and I let, you know, the people that know better than me kind of wake them up and put them down if they need to. Put them down being, you know, anesthetize them, I mean. And then certainly the dogs and cats are a little logistically easier. But, you know, some of the more exotic species are dangerous. You know, they don't handle the drugs very well. Or, you know, I always thought this was funny. You know, if you were to I'm not sure funny is the right word, but interesting, if you were to try to euthanize a turtle or anesthetize a turtle, how do you do that? You know, they can hold their breath for hours. You know, we use gas anesthetics for the most part. And so if you wanted to, you know, make a turtle unconscious, you have to be very, very patient. You have to, you know, potentially take a lot of steps to make them inhale this gas. Or conversely, if they're trying to wake up, you know, they have to blow off, they have to exhale a lot of the gas, which means
wow.
They'll be sitting there for hours waiting for these turtles to wake up. It really does take a special skill set to do some of those things. And again, I'm not saying I'm an expert in any of it, but, you know, it's a wide array of knowledge that, you know, various veterinarians have that, you know, is really amazing to me. And so, yeah, when I was in Seattle, you know, I did primarily dogs, cats, and horses. I hung on to doing the horse thing because that's a very unique challenge. Now that I'm out here, I don't do so much horses. It's on my radar to do again because I think there probably is a demand for it. But at least right now, the logistics are a little bit more than me and the development company that I work for can do.
Yeah, what brought you east across the country?
Yeah, so what brought me east? So I don't remember exactly the details, but I was looking for a professional change, and I'll say that as diplomatically as I can. And Jason Berg, who's a neurologist, who's a veterinary neurologist, he was starting this hospital called Guardian Vet Specialist, which is where I work now. And you know, I just on a whim reached out to him and said, "Hey, you know, I'm entertaining some changes. You know, what you got going on? You know, I'm kind of interested in seeing the area and you know, what you're planning with this new startup hospital, really." And so I came out. He flew me out. You know, I visited for, I don't remember, 3-5 days. He showed me around. He showed me the hospital. You've been in the hospital, but you know, at the time, and it's a big hospital, right? At the time, it was a shell. It was exterior walls and wood beams on the inside. And so I walked through this hospital thinking, holy cow, you got a lot of work yet to do. But, you know, he sold me on the idea that, you know, we're going to be this great, truly state-of-the-art hospital, you know, that offers things that nobody else offers, that has a culture of people that respect each other and communicate efficiently and treat people well and really just ultimately do the right thing every single time. And, you know, we haven't done all of that yet, but I think it's a realistic goal to achieve in the very near future. And so, you know, that's really what brought me out here. And, you know, so I moved out here, you know, probably 8-10 months after I originally visited. And, you know, it was just about as the hospital was opening. So I've been here for 16 months now, something like that. And, you know, again, I think we're in a very nice position with the company developing this, something I think we're all going to be proud of.
My own medical doctors are all members of the CAMOUNT network, which has impressive buildings all over the Hudson Valley. The Guardian building reminds me of one of those. I was very impressed both with the way people handle patients at the desk, the way the staff talk to you. And of course the building, which to me is in the middle of nowhere, all of a sudden I find it is this giant building where I was very impressed with it. Obviously you have a reputation because both the people that I got Coco through this rescue agency and my own vet both recommended you, so you obviously built the reputation and not a very long time, so that's good.
Yeah, somebody's got faith in us.
What should pet owners be on the watch for concerning their pet's vision or eye health?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't have, you know, too many general rules that I throw out there, but I'll tell you, you know, once again, you know, one of the main things I want to emphasize is, you know, age is really not a disease. That's like dogma in you know, among veterinarians. There's nothing age, you know, age doesn't really cause anything. You know, diseases cause things, you know, and we all get diseases as we get older, right? We get arthritis, we get, you know, hair loss or whatever, right? And, you know, in dogs and cats and other species, it's exactly the same thing. You know, they get old, but, you know, they're slowing down or they're having trouble because they have a disease. And, you know, the common things that I hear is, oh, you know, he's 12, 14, however old, and his eyes are looking cloudy. That's disease happening in most cases. Or, you know, oh, he doesn't get around so good in the dark anymore. That's often an early indication of a disease happening where, you know, the dogs or cats for that matter start having trouble in the dark before they actually have trouble during daylight. You know, and so, you know, those subtle things, it goes back to, I don't want to dismiss things that are potentially early signs of disease that you know, pet owners, for better or worse, frequently do. And this applies to, you know, not just ophthalmology, but almost any specialty. You know, the orthopedic surgeons would say the same thing, you know. You know, your dog's having trouble getting up or laying down or climbing stairs. You know, that's disease that's happening. And the question is there anything realistically to do about it? And oftentimes, you know, even if it's not majorly invasive surgeries or tests, you know, there's pretty simple steps that can be helpful. And so, you know, that's, I think, the one thing that I really want to emphasize is, is, you know, as dogs get older, animals get older, yeah, they slow down, but, you know, it's very important to make sure they're slowing down for reasons that we cannot or should not intervene for.
Okay. Coco condition involved swollen and inflamed eyes, the blood coming from in her nose, apparently over resulting from a respiratory infection. Is this a condition common among kittens?
Yeah, so I see infectious disease very common in cats. Kitten particularly, they get, they often acquire infectious agents from their mothers, you know, so they're passed during, you know, parturition or giving birth or, you know, via milk or, you know, just contact, you know, nose-to-nose type contact. And so, you know, I often see infectious conjunctivitis, corneal problems, respiratory problems, you know, in young cats. And, you know, they could be as young as a week or two of age. They could be, you know, 4 or 6 months of age, you know, before some of this stuff manifests. And it's commonly viral. Feline herpes virus is a very common thing. That's one of the things we treated Coco for. Less commonly, there's bacterial components. Once again, going back to, you know, potentially some of the, quote, sexually transmitted diseases, chlamydia, what used to be called chlamydia, now we call chlamydophila, is a common bacterial infection in cats. Mycoplasma is very similar. That could cause very similar signs. And then there's a few other things as well, but they become much less frequent. So these types of problems, particularly in the young animals, is very common. And dogs don't get so much of the viral problems, but they get more bacterial problems. Happens in them, too, when they're just pups. You know, you asked about species differences a while back, and, you know, there's an enormous array of different species-specific problems that develop. You know, feline herpes only affects cats. You know, that's a common question I get too is, well, can you give it to me or my dog or whoever else? And the answer is no. Feline herpes only specifically affects cats. But certainly, you know, there are, and I guess that's common. You know, it's, you know, you get these species specific problems that, you know, most people don't even think about because, you know, we're not, for whatever reason, able to. Educate the pet owning population quite as well as, you know, lots of physicians can educate about pink eye or whatever, Bordetella, or I'm sorry, not Bordetella, whooping cough, which may be Bordetella as I recall, you know, among kids. And, you know, these dog and cat problems don't really stick with people too well, certainly not in a public way.
Well, I'm happy to say that between antibiotics and the ointment that you prescribed, the condition has, by and large, cleared up. You recently participated in veterinary board certification testing in North Carolina. Tell us about that process, if you will.
Yeah, so that process, I'm part of the examination committee for the veterinary ophthalmology community, which basically means I design, administer, and grade the examination for residents, candidates to become board certified in veterinary ophthalmology. And the process is fairly grueling. You know, we do it once a year. It's in North Carolina, at least most recently, and it may shift around in location a little bit. But the process really involves 3 to 4 days of testing for each of these candidates. They take, you know, an academic test where they have to, you know the current literature and some of the, a fair number of textbooks and those types of things and kind of be a fact-based test. Then we have another portion where the candidates have to review images, videos, those types of things, and make an assessment based on what we're showing them on a computer screen. And then we ultimately have a what I consider the culmination of everything where we have to, a team of us watches each candidate perform surgical procedures, which is always, I think, very, you know, very nerve-wracking for the candidate because, you know, now you have, you know, three people, generally speaking, watching each candidate within 3 feet of them perform surgeries that they should know how to do in order to be adequately qualified to go out and practice what we do every day. And like I alluded to before, it's always funny because now we have these nervous candidates whose hands are really shaking, right? You know, they're trembling like mad because this is the culmination of, you know, 3, 4, 8 years of work. And it's all, you know, dependent on what they do in the next hour. And so I almost feel like telling them, you know, control your breathing, control your hands, just like, you know, I mentioned earlier. But, you know, I can't do that as an examiner because I have to stay relatively objective. And my job isn't to coach them. My job is to grade them. And so that's really what it entails. And so, you know, it's a fairly grueling type of exam for them to go through. And as far as I know, there's only one other vendor of specialty certification that has a surgical or practical portion like that, and it's dentistry, which I always thought was kind of an interesting thing because, you know, you don't consider dentistry, traditionally speaking, to be all that demanding. But, you know, I think their test is equally challenging compared to ours. And, you know, the specialists always have a competition, you know, kind of a friendly competition of, oh, you know, who has the highest and lowest pass rates among all the specialty exams, you know, trying to correlate it with the difficulty of what they actually do every day, which, you know, is obviously a flawed argument. But it seems like, you know, fairly consistently ophthalmology is, you know, a pretty low pass rate, probably because of how extensive the exam is, which is by design in part because we really want to make sure people that go out there and start doing these high skill level or high knowledge and skill level processes are adequately qualified. Because as you know, I mean, you know, what we do isn't inexpensive, and, you know, it's very, very technically challenging. And so, you know, we try to do our best to make sure the people that get board certification are qualified.
Sure. What is the cage liner, and how did you get involved with that?
So the cage liner, you know, to give you a little, a cage liner is basically the material we put in dog cages, dog runs, and cat cages and runs for when animals inadvertently soil themselves when they're in the hospital. You know, and this happens for any number of medical reasons. And, you know, it's designed so that you can just pull out the liner and keep things clean and move on, right? So the cage liner is a satirical website. This is the website cagelinervet.com, I believe. It's a satirical website designed mostly for veterinarians. You know, it's poking fun at some of the common problems common situations that we find ourselves in. It's designed to really just be satire, kind of like The Onion, you know, for veterinary medicine, though. And, you know, it was, I'm not sure anyone can take full credit because there's a number of authors in this. And, you know, I don't want to share too many names because some of them have remained anonymous for reasons because, you know, some of the jokes we make are a little bit controversial, so to speak. And so, you know, we came up with this idea 2-3 years ago, but we had been entertaining it for years prior to that. But, you know, it wasn't until in the last few years where we actually put something in motion. And, you know, it's just something we have fun with. We make jokes about, you know, again, these common situations we find ourselves in. You know, we joke about, you know, one article I remember, you know, somebody wrote about how, you know, they were deobstipating a cat. Deobstipation is basically removing dried fecal matter from the rectum of a cat who no longer can defecate. Because it's so dehydrated. And so we made somebody made this joke about this process where a veterinarian is now graduating first in their class, you know, summa cum laude, you know, 4.0s, all this kind of stuff, and that's what they're doing, right? And so, you know, it's really designed for the veterinary community to kind of laugh at themselves a little bit more than anything. And, you know, it has a little bit of following. It's not a huge thing, but I do think people get a kick out of it, at least from our side of things. Certainly, I think a lot of the jokes would be over pet owner heads, I think.
Is this your first venture at humor writing?
It's my first venture, absolutely. I think one of the authors, Sarah Boston, she's a surgeon based in Toronto. I think she does any number of, I think she does stand-up. She writes for any number of other blogs. So I think she's probably the most public figure involved in all this. But she's done a lot of different things.
You're also a dog owner. What breed?
I have two mutts, sorry. One is a failed guide dog. I got him during my residency in Iowa. He came in for an eye exam because you should have eye exams in guide dogs because we need to make sure that their vision's good. And you should have eye exams in animals that are going to breed because we can identify a lot of genetic problems that even if they're not a big deal now, they will become a big deal or potentially a big deal in the offspring. And so he came in for an eye exam during my residency, and we looked at him and said, oh, yeah, he shouldn't be a guide dog because he's got a really bad right eye. And at the time, it wasn't blind, and it's now blind because the disease progressed. But his left eye is very healthy, and he functions pretty good. But what's always interesting about him, his name's Walter, is I had him for about a week after he was given up. And he started having a seizure. And I thought, oh, great, now I have a dog that's having a seizure. And sure enough, I went through the whole process of trying to figure out what caused the seizure, and it turns out he's just an epileptic. So he's on seizure, anticonvulsant medication, right? And so now it's doubly good that he's not a guide dog, because a guide dog, obviously, that can only see out one eye and falls down having seizures once in a while is not a very effective guide dog. So he's my guy here. He's 5 or 6 years old at this point. My other dog is Belle, or Belly, as I call her. I don't even know what she is. She's like a border collie mix, border collie pit bully looking thing. She's my old dog. She's 13, maybe pushing 14. Had her since vet school. I found her during vet school. She was I found her in construction site during vet school. And she barked at me the first time I saw her, and I thought, oh, screw that dog, I'm leaving. And then a little bit later that day, I felt bad, so I took her a jug of water and a bowl of food, and then we were best friends, and I opened up my car, and she jumped right in the back seat. So now I got a dog. And she's good, she's just an old dog, she's a little slow on her back legs, she's got some lower back pain, she's deaf, but she gets around pretty good. We go on walks, once every day or two. We go slow, but, she does pretty good. Otherwise, she's really pretty healthy. She's just slowing down with her back and her legs.
Yeah. What's next for you?
What's next for me? That's a pretty broad question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what's next for me. I think it's still very much up in the air. This is, my move here is still new enough that I'm not really thinking what's next. I don't have a wife or kids, so that type of stuff's always on the radar. I don't plan to make any professional moves in the near future because I'm pretty happy with where I am here. I'm not sure I have a solid answer to what's next.
Okay. That's okay. We've touched a lot the bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about you?
What else did you know about me? I'm not sure there's much else I need to share. I think we covered most of it. You're right. We touched on a lot of things. I'd be curious if anyone called in with questions, but, I agree. We've really covered a lot of bases.
Okay. Well, then thank you very much, Carl. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, again, I'm happy to do it, and it was very interesting. We're a little bit over time even, huh?
Yeah, but that's okay. Send any questions or comments to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com, and be sure to join us next week at the same time with writer, poet, and memorist Linda with the Y Coop. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for URLs of previous shows. My books, as Kyle said, are available at Amazon. Now, in the words, the Mets right now, so Howie Rose, if the Mets win put it in the book and until next week. And my AI just went off. Amazon cancel, but I'll let Amazon check us off with the Eagles. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Playing Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library on Amazon Music.
I like the way sparkling earrings play against your skin so brown. And I want to sleep with you in the desert tonight, with a billion stars all around. 'Cause I got a peaceful, easy feeling.
Thanks again, Kyle. And good night, everybody.
Yes.
And I found out.